Good evening. Welcome to Bay Presbyterian Church's 2014 American Heritage Series, Darwinism and the Descent of Culture. Our speaker this evening will be Dr. Mark Wardell, whose topic will be A Brief History and the Flawed Science of Darwinism. Dr. Wardell earned his PhD in clinical biochemistry from the University of Otago in his native New Zealand in 1986. Following that, he left New Zealand to further his career in medical science abroad. His area of interest in research is how the aberrant structure and function of proteins contributes to human disease. After a postdoctoral fellowship at the Gladstone Foundation, he took a position in the Department of Hematology at Cambridge University, England, where he taught graduate and medical students. While at Cambridge, he solved the detailed three-dimensional structure of protein targets at the atomic level to further the development of rational drug designs. His interests include family, tennis, many other sports, the creation-evolution debate, missions, biblical counseling, and the hope that is to come when Christ returns. Dr. Wardell also serves as a ruling elder at Westminster Presbyterian Church, Fort Myers. Before we welcome Dr. Wardell, let's bow our heads for a moment of prayer. Father, we thank you for this evening. We thank you for the opportunity to gather together. We thank you above all that you are the sovereign God who has created us and sustains us. We ask now that you would open our hearts and our minds and that you would enable us to come away more firmly convinced that you are the one who has designed all things. We ask this in Christ's name. Now, please welcome Dr. Wardell.
Thank you very much. It is indeed an honor to be here. You're hearing a taste of the future in the accent. Get used to it. So I've been asked to start the series this year for you, and it is indeed a privilege and an honor to do so, and I thank you for the invitation. I'd like to try to tell you a little bit about my own journey with this topic and why I believe now what I believe. But I'm going to do that, if you will allow me, from a strictly scientific point of view. I'm going to leave out my own personal faith, and the reason is because in these kind of discussions, the evolutionists are very want to criticize creationists from coming from a wrong position. And so I strictly am going to talk to you about my own experience that the Lord has taken me through in a scientific career. So without further ado, let's move on. The flow of the discussion tonight, I'd like to define Darwinism for you. It has changed since its initial, the way it was initially put forward by Charles Darwin. Explain where it came from and how it has changed and developed. Confess what I think of it. I was asked to do that. And as a scientist, discuss why I think it is flawed. Well, the theory, and by the way, I normally use a laser pointer and like to point, but the new technology is one step ahead of us, like some of these superbugs are one step ahead of our antibiotics. And we haven't, unless I get out the old aerial from the car, using it on these screens is difficult. So I apologize, and if necessary, I'll tell you where to look. But I'll just be reading some of these word slides for you so you can follow along. The theory of the evolutionary mechanism proposed by Charles Darwin as an explanation of organic change is how we would define Darwinism. It denotes Darwin's specific view of how evolution works. He developed the concept that evolution is brought about by the interplay of three main principles. In his day, this is where it stood. Variation, that is present in all forms of life, and I'm sure you know the genetic variation within the human population, we don't all look the same. We don't all have the same colored skin. We don't have the same eye color and so on. That's the variation we're talking about here. Heredity, the force that transmits similar organic form from one generation to another, and the struggle for existence, which has since Darwin been defined as survival of the fittest. As you went through school, maybe you came across that term. It determines the variations that will be advantageous in a given environment, thus altering the species through selective reproduction. And it should be noted in this definition that widely divergent groups of plants and animals have arisen from the same ancestors. That is the form of the definition that applies to Darwinism. So you have the classical one, from monkeys to humans, or if you want, from amoeba to humans. That's what it means. It is the common ancestors that we all come from, is what they mean by that. Now, just a little bit about where this theory came from. I'm sure you've all heard of Charles Darwin. He's been most instrumental in our lifetime, and I'm sure everyone's heard of him. If you were introduced to him, maybe at the Scopes trial, and if not, I'm sure you've had other run-ins with people on the other side. So he was an English naturalist, a geologist, who postulated that all species of life have descended over time from common ancestors by a process of evolution. And there he is at the age 45, and then later on, not long before his death in 82. He was very sick for a lot of his life. His early interest in nature led him to neglect his medical education at the University of Edinburgh. And instead, he helped to investigate marine invertebrates, and he studied at the University of Cambridge and was encouraged by his work in the natural sciences there. And then he was asked to go on a 5-year expedition on the Beagle. And if we look at the next slide, you'll see they circumnavigated the globe in that 5 years. And whereas he was there to be put off on the shore of these many lands that they went by, while the captain and the rest of the crew would map the shorelines of the countries that they were going through. So he was on his own with an assistant a lot of the time, and in the Galapagos Islands, of course, where he did his famous work on finches. He was puzzled by the geographical distribution of wildlife and fossils he collected on the voyage. There were differences from one geographical region to another, and that puzzled him. And he began a detailed investigation, and in 1838 conceived his theory of natural selection. He wrote many scientific articles and books, and the one that I'm sure you've all heard of is On the Origin of Species. But that's not the end of the title. That's probably what you know and have heard about. The real title is On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or the Preservation of Favored Races and the Struggle for Life, published in 1859. And he was very active in publishing work, and he became famous in England and then throughout Europe by publishing the stories of his journal of this 5-year voyage on the Beagle. He also became internationally famous through his book here, this particular book, and was elected as a Fellow of the Royal Society and also honored with a burial in Westminster Abbey. He has been described as one of the most influential figures in human history, and there's some pictures of the Galapagos finches that helped make him famous. Now, the meaning of Darwinism has changed over time, and I'm not sure if he were to come back today he would even recognize it. But his theory of natural selection is still very much engrossed in the theory. So let me try to just briefly tell you this. I want to move on more as to some of the problems with this theory and spend most of the time there. But how it is normally taught today, your grandkids and children are learning, in the modern evolutionary synthesis, as it has been coined in a book in 1942. And a lot of the change in understanding of it and the teaching of it occurred between 1930 and 1948 and incorporated natural selection, one of Darwin's chief advocations in this. It incorporated his theory of natural selection with new population genetics that had been done. He didn't know Mendel. He didn't know of Mendel's work. Mendel came after Darwin, so Mendel was tremendously influential in helping to formulate the modern evolutionary synthesis, which is really neo-Darwinism, and I'm sure you've heard of that. It's just Darwinism with a twist, if you will. And the modern synthesis drew together ideas from several branches, several fields, including biology and genetics, cytology, systematics, botany, morphology, ecology, and paleontology. And so the findings from a broad range of disciplines were incorporated into the modern evolutionary synthesis. And it could be summarized from Julian Huxley's book called Evolution, the Modern Synthesis, 1942, according to these six conditions. One, all evolutionary phenomena can be explained in a way consistent with known genetic mechanisms and the observational evidence of naturalists. Two, evolution is gradual. Small genetic changes regulated by natural selection accumulate over long periods. Discontinuities amongst species or other taxa, and we're going to talk about that word species in a little bit, are explained as originating gradually through geographical separation and extinction. And this theory contrasts with the saltation theory of Bateson in 1894, where the fossil record does not support gradual evolution. There tend to be very abrupt changes in skeletal architecture and so on, rather than intermediates. You've all heard that. You can't find the intermediates between this form of man and that form of man, for example. So saltation is just where you have a very abrupt change from one morphology to another. Number three, natural selection is by far the main mechanism of change. Even slight advantages are important when continued. The object of selection is the phenotype in its natural environment. Number four, the role of genetic drift is equivocal. I won't belabor that. Number five, thinking in terms of populations rather than individuals is very important. The genetic diversity existing in natural populations is a key factor. So we have to consider populations rather than individuals. And in paleontology, the ability to explain historical observations by extrapolation from microevolution to macroevolution, I'm going to define those terms in a minute for you, is proposed. So let's do that in a moment here. I was asked to say what I thought of this, of Darwinism and neo-Darwinism as it is today, or the modern synthesis, and I ask you, do you want the long answer or the short answer? I'll give you both anyway. But before I give either of them, I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page with what we mean by this. Evolution is such a slippery word, isn't it? I'm sure you've come across that in your own life. And what one person means by it can be completely different from what someone else means by it. And I just want to make sure that we have evolution understood in what we're going to talk about tonight. It's a bit like the word evangelical, which or Calvinism, which have vast meanings. For example, those who are frustrated during political elections by the evangelical people would use the word derogatorily, would they not? And yet, within Christendom, evangelical has changed out of all recognition from its original meaning as well. So goes evolution. So let me define it in the way I'd like to talk about it tonight. For the purposes of our discussion, we're talking about naturalistic evolution in a neo-Darwinian sense, where the National Association of Biology Teachers in the United States would define it as the diversity of life on Earth is the outcome of evolution, an unpredictable and natural process of temporal descent with genetic modification that is affected by natural selection. It is affected by chance. It is affected by historical contingencies and changing environments. And that's it. Another definition that leads us into these terms, macro and micro evolution, is that evolution is the descent with modification encompassing small-scale evolution, changes in gene frequency within a population from one generation to the next. And we'll look at an example of that. So if that's not clear to you right now, hopefully it will be in a moment. And it's also descent of large-scale evolution, which is the descent of different species from a common ancestor over many generations. And so let's look just a little bit before we move on to something I hope you find more interesting at these terms micro and macro, because I think they're very important. And if you're talking to somebody who is a proponent of Darwinism and evolution, they use these terms without distinction. So evolution is both micro and macro. So microevolution is the genetic variations over time within certain limits, i.e. within a type or kind. I'm going to use the word kind tonight because you may recognize it from Genesis 1 and 2. And there is some difficulty in defining what a species is, but a kind or a type or a species I'm going to use interchangeably tonight. Just want to remind you that there are some slight differences that we don't have to worry about tonight. So I'll probably use the word kind because that's in Genesis 1 and 2 that you're probably familiar with. Now, change happens within a group, but the descendant is clearly the same type or kind as the ancestor. There's been no change in the kind, during microevolution. In contrast, macroevolution is that which crosses the boundary of the kind and refers to major evolutionary changes over time, such as a fish descending from an invertebrate animal or a whale descending from a land mammal, for example. Okay, changes across kinds or species. Now, what do I think of neo-Darwinian evolution or the modern synthesis? Well, from these definitions I just gave you, I have no problem with microevolution, although I wouldn't use that term, but knowing what it means, I think it's something that is very natural to us and just describes the genetic variability within any one population of kind, or within any one species, that is. It just is wise sometimes not to use the word microevolution, whereas other times it's appropriate. And it simply expresses the genetic variation that already exists. We see this in dog breeds, from Chihuahua to Great Danes and beyond. The same kind, vast differences in the genetic expression of the dog genome. We see it in horse coat colors, from white horses to black and everything in between, duns and roans and skewballs and piebalds and palominos and all the rest. They're all horse. Now, whilst I do say that I'm okay with micro, I do not believe in macro evolution, which claims that unpredictable natural processes cause new kinds to occur by major evolutionary changes within an existing kind. And I'm going to tell you why I don't believe in that from my scientific studies. And basically, I've not seen any convincing scientific evidence of macroevolution. And I believe the presuppositions underpinning such evolutionary change are, to put it nicely, unsustainable. Well, why do I think the modern synthesis is flawed? Well, since I began to try to understand the theory, I have not seen any experimental evidence that passes any kind of reasonable standard of scientific rigor that supports the evolution of one kind from another. And I could digress and explain to you how one goes about a typical experiment in the research laboratory, but it is very rigorous. And one doesn't believe the results unless one has controls and certain events are reproducible and can be done by multiple people. That's the kind of rigor I'm talking about. There's just, I can't find any in the evolutionary theory to substantiate a jump out of one kind of population into another. And I've looked at it not only from my own discipline, let's say of biochemistry. I'm going to go through the six different disciplines that I've looked at it from now in the time that remains, and hopefully you'll understand why I've come to this view. So let's start with biology. Now, the peppered moth story, I'm sure you've all studied from textbooks in your past, if not yourself, then perhaps with your children, or even your grandchildren, because it's still in the books. And it is purported to be a good example of evolution. And I would say to you, it's like going from a Chihuahua to a German Shepherd. You're still a peppered moth, but because of the Industrial Revolution in Britain, putting soot and dirt on the trees on which they fly around and land on, it changes whether or not they are visible or invisible. There's two moths on that trunk. One's a white-bodied moth, known as typica, and the other is the black-bodied moth, known as carbonaria. Not that that is a different kind or a different species, just a name given to them. And you'll see there that the white moth, although not as well as I'll show you in another slide, is not as easily seen by birds that might predate it. But here's another one. Can you see the black moth on the left-hand side there? He's pretty well hidden underneath the white-bodied moth, is he not? And in the middle one, there's a white moth on the lichen. Can you see him? He's down near the bottom. Very difficult to see. And there again on the right, where you have these trees that are polluted with soot and dirt, it's very difficult to see the black-bodied moth below the white-bodied moth. So as the Industrial Revolution proceeded, you see, the white moths that used to have an advantage in camouflage lost it, and the black moths gained it, and so by simple predation, the numbers in the population of whether you're black or white changed. I don't see that as jumping out of one kind into another at all, but simply an expression of the advantage of being white in, let's say, 1870 and being black in 1930, you see. Well, the typica and carbonaria are not two different kinds, and I've said all I want to say on that. Let's move from biology, where I gave you an example that's well known, that doesn't meet the stringency of macroevolution. But it is still fiercely defended as an example of evolution within those who subscribe to Darwinian theory. So what about genetics? Now, there's so many of these I could have thrown up, and we're very short on time here tonight, so I'll tell you about one that you possibly heard about in the popular press in 2005. Actually, it began in 95, but in 2005, this Nature, which is one of the two top scientific journals in the world, Nature and Science, Nature's published in the UK, Science in this country, they tend to take the top, so-called top scientific discoveries and publish them. It's very, very difficult to get published in either of them. But they came out after the chimpanzee genome had been sequenced, and I assume you might know what that means. If not, I'll try to point it out when we look at a picture of a cell in a little bit. But it had on the cover, chimpanzee genome 99% identical to human genome. Therefore, we are descended from the monkeys. To which I immediately thought, well, what about all these differences? I've never seen the chimpanzees on the right-hand side going around traffic in mega cities with cars everywhere. The difference in understanding and being able to play musical instruments is quite markedly different, from an orchestra to this guy getting his lips ready. We see differences in the two kinds at a concert, marked differences. Whilst you might see the human participating in a concert like the chimpanzee from time to time, you won't see the converse. But they're only 1% different in their genetic makeup. At least that's what was thought. Downtown tends to look a little different. I've never seen any skyscrapers in the jungle. The way that we take to flight is a little different. One jumps from a branch to branch, and the other can go up on the 747 with a space shuttle on its back. And looking over the world can have a slightly different understanding too, you see. But 1% makes a big difference, doesn't it? Well, the evaluation of the methodology of the experiment resulting in the claim that the chimp genome sequence was 99% identical to the human genome revealed severe deficiencies. I'm sure you have had to tell your children from time to time, no, that's not the way you clean your room. That's not the way you do the dishes. The methodology is flawed. Well, that's the case here. For methodological convenience, the early estimates of genome similarity used only what we call single copy DNA. It's a fraction of the DNA, and it's a very small fraction that tends to align very easily. And the majority of the DNA was omitted from the genome in the experiments. Also, the earlier work from the mid-1970s into the new millennium, into the 2000s, were done during an era of very strong belief, largely driven by neo-Darwinian understanding, that only the coding sequences in DNA were important. Now, the coding sequences I'll try to point out to you in a future slide, but that is, they are the genes, if you will, within the genome that transcribe proteins, which go out into the body of the organism and do all the work. So genes stay in the nucleus. They don't do anything. They just make proteins. And the proteins are the gene products that go out and do the biochemical reactions, for example. Enzymes are proteins made by genes. So if you just select for that very small percentage of the genome that transcribes proteins, you're going to get a totally different picture of what's going on than if you look at the entire genome. And that's what was done. They just looked at the coding sequence. And it was in an era where I was raised on it all through my college years, steady diet day by day, that one gene, one protein, etc. And I'm sure you guys did if you did biology as well. Well, that's turned out not to be true. Well, using a more stringent methodology and taking all the chromosome into consideration, a more recent analysis found only 62% sequence similarity, quite different from 99%. And the variation was between 72% of the X chromosome similarity and 30% similarity on the Y chromosome. But overall, it was 62% similar. But of even more importance than that is that the classic evolutionary theory of DNA gene coding sequences I just alluded to, that is coding for proteins, being the very important sequences, has been discarded since this work was done for a new appreciation for the majority of the genome that we always called in my day at college junk DNA. That's what it was called. Well, here is a gene architecture of a very small part of a chromosome. It's DNA architecture, really, and it shows you there's a horizontal line through there of DNA, and it shows you in the red boxes where parts of the coding sequence come up, and between they're called exons, if any of you have studied this, and I don't want to get you bogged down in scientific terminology, but you can see that the exon sequences that represent the overall part of the horizontal line are very small compared to the remainder of it. Can you notice that there? Basically, where the arrows are pointing to used to be called junk DNA, and it has been found to have regulatory elements, and it can turn genes on and off, and there's even now you can slide the coding, and one gene can code for multiple proteins, it can code for active RNA molecules, all kinds of new things that have come out in the last few years, so that it's very hard to understand anymore what the real Darwinian theory is, because it's changing as you go to bed at night. And that's one of the problems I have trying to keep up with it and understand exactly what it is. It changes. I'm going to show you some other major changes. So the changing face of genetics is one reason why I have had a great deal of difficulty subscribing to macroevolution. Understanding the DNA and chromosome structure function relationships is rapidly expanding, and new theories are constantly being developed. And what was held as dogma yesterday, one gene, one protein, for example, coding sequences are everything. Darwinian evolution is the expression of gene allele frequencies that totally control macroevolutionary process has had to be thrown out the window. And new theories have come in to replace them. But we will not let go of the theory as a whole. We just simply try to re-explain it. And I'll show you at the very end the limit to which that has been taken. It's called panspermia. You're going to love what that tells us. The genetic code that used to underpin the evolutionary theory has changed, and it's therefore dangerous to claim that similarities categorically prove common ancestry. For example, we have here a nice line that could, I've got another one that shows monkeys to man, but did the fork give rise, did the fork come from the knife through a series of butter knife, spoon, and so on? They're all made of the same substance. If we were to melt them down and weigh what was in there and do a chemical analysis, they would look identical. And that's kind of what's done when we analyze a genome. The designer, if you will, of the process has used the same building blocks, and so you're going to see similarities. In the bottom, I show you the evolution of wheels, man helping carts and transportation devices that go from one wheel to two, to three, to four, to six, and to 18. And I'm sure some way they'd be able to explain a macroevolutionary process in those devices there. But that's the kind of thing that's happening. Well, let's turn from... I know that you're already warmed up now, and we're going to take on biophysics, the second law of thermodynamics. Now, I've tried to make this very simple, maybe too simple. And if you know, it applies in your house every day. If you have kids, you say, "Please go and clean up your room," and they say, "No, I'm doing an experiment on the second law of thermodynamics." And that is, it always tends to disorder. That is the theory, to chaos. And you can see that in your house. A natural process always takes place in such a direction as to cause an increase in the entropy, that is, disorder, if you will, of the universe. Now, think about it. Evolution is supposed to be decreasing the disorder and building order, you see. The various parts... in our case, molecules, become less and less organized, according to the second law of thermodynamics, and more random. And I'll talk about an application of that you'll right now. A house can be built by the application of purposeful directed energy. You get up in the morning, you put on your hammer and screwdriver, and you sweat energies going into the process. You're banging nails. And that energy results in a beautiful new house, very ordered. But if you don't maintain that house year by year, month by month, what happens to it? Somehow it spontaneously disintegrates, doesn't it? And that's what we're talking about. The tendency is always to increase entropy, increase disorder, for things to fall down, disintegrate, return back to their elemental components. And so along the way, though, of you in putting energy into building your house, a lot of it's wasted in friction and noise and so on. Sound energy and frictional energy can be lost. So although energy is always conserved, some of it is not useful energy. But a house will eventually become a pile of rubble if you don't continue to put directed energy into it. Your office desk is another good example, or at least mine is, of the second law of thermodynamics. Unless you apply purposeful directed energy or ask your wife on bended knee to come in and help you, it is astounding how quickly increased entropy can be observed. One of the basic assumptions of the theory of Darwinian evolution is that somehow over billions of years, very simple elements and compounds combined and stayed combined, okay, unlike your house, which would not stay combined if you don't apply energy to it, an ever-increasing complexity as evolution goes from single-celled to multi-celled organisms, it gets more and more complex. And that goes against the second law of thermodynamics. And unless there's a guiding, directed, energetic force, I have a great deal of difficulty seeing how that can happen spontaneously and naturally. And that's why I raise it as something that was a stumbling block for me to accept the theory. So we don't expect simple molecules to become complex in a random fashion. Perhaps time helps, and this is where the evolutionary theory claim is on their side. What about the Earth's been around billions of years? There's lots of time, and random things can happen. So the only means to maintain the theory of evolution in light of the second law of thermodynamics is to postulate that while chance combinations of simple molecules into exceedingly complex ones would be very rare, given enough time, billions of years, it could happen. Now, I don't know about you, but that certainly requires me to exercise faith, because there's no evidence. It could happen? Okay. All right. And in fact, it is theorized, and this is precisely what happened. Now, Julius Huxley, in his famous argument that given enough time, a million monkeys typing on a million typewriters would eventually produce a Shakespearean play, is based on such thinking. After all, over a period of billions of years, surely many extremely improbable events could occur, perhaps even a systematic and monumental exception to the second law of thermodynamics could occur given a few billion years. Well, let's look at do a mathematical check on this. Now, this is where I have to go. Wake up. Maths. It's math time. Relatively simple mathematical techniques, you'll be relieved to hear, can help us better understand the probability of the occurrence of such chance events. All that are necessary are some basic assumptions. Let's assume that 1 million monkeys typing 24 hours a day on 1 million typewriters, having 40 keys each, and we'll make those assumptions. We'll assume that each monkey types 100 words per minute. And how long might we expect it to take for one of them to type Othello? Which starts, "Never tell me. I take it much unkindly." We don't need to go beyond that, by the way. The probability of randomly hitting the letter N for the first word, never, followed immediately by an E, is 1 over 40 times 1 over 40. There's 40 keys on the typewriter. You could choose any one of them to hit N the first time, as you've got 1 in 40 chance. To hit E the second time, you've got 1 in 40 chance. It's pretty simple math. Or a 1 out of 1,600. The probability of typing never, that is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 letters, is 1 over 40 times 1 over 40 times 1 over 40 times 1 over 40 times 1 over 40, or about 1 out of 100 million. And so we now set these guys to work, and each typing 500 characters per minute, we have 8.33 characters per second, they'd be able to type 8.33 million times 10 to the 6, that's a million characters per second. Therefore, we could expect one of them to type the first word in about 12 seconds. But 100 million divided by 8 times 10 to the 6, that's 12 seconds. However, the first 20 characters becomes a huge problem. Because the characters and spaces, remember, you have to take into account. Getting us into the fifth word would require 40 to the power of 20 divided by 8.33 over 10 to the 6 seconds, or more than 4 times 10 to the 17 years. Now, you're not going to be here for that, and neither are the monkeys. Now, astronomers and cosmologists would agree that's about 20 times the age of the universe. You may not agree with that, but astrologers and cosmologists believe that the time it would take the monkeys to type into the fifth word 20 characters, 1 million of them on 1 million typewriters, will take 20 times the estimated age of the universe, which is anywhere between 14 and 20 billion years, depending on who you talk to. Now, We can apply the same analysis to predict how long it would take by random chance a protein molecule to form out there in the primordial soup. Have you all heard of the primordial soup? Should have. It was in vogue in the 1950s. Now, Harold F. Blum, a Princeton University physicist, points out that if we assume an abundant supply of amino acid building blocks, so no lack of building blocks, all the proper catalysts, I mean, we're really priming the pump, favorable temperature and moisture, the chance of getting only a 10 amino acid peptide, that is, most protein, the average protein in your body has a molecular weight of about 50,000, and each amino acid, the average amino acid weight would be 110. So you do the math as to how many amino acids are in there. It's a few hundred. We're talking about 10 here. We're just asking them to make a 10 amino acid peptide. Well, it would be, the probability of that would be 1 to the power of 20. And I might just tell you that it's calculated that the number of atoms in the universe is 10 to the power of 80 in the universe. Okay? So when you go up by a power of 10 each time, or power, you know, 20 to 21, you're getting into some huge numbers, numbers you can't even think of. You'd be writing zeros until you passed away, and then you wouldn't be done. Now, the average length of bacterial proteins is 200 bacterial proteins, those tiny little single-celled organisms. We're not talking about very highly evolved animals here. There are 267 amino acids. We just did an analysis of 10 and got 10 to the 20 power. So, you know, the next step to support life, you can see that the chance of it happening randomly, if we left it, you know, in the primordial soup, is inconceivable. These relatively simple biophysical considerations and mathematical calculations have caused many notable scientists who have thought logically about the matter to draw conclusions similar to Nobel Prize winner Sir Ernest Chain, who said, "To postulate that the development and survival of the fittest is entirely a consequence of chance mutations seems to me a hypothesis based on no evidence and irreconcilable with the facts. These classical evolutionary theories are a gross oversimplification of an immensely complex and intricate mass of facts, and it amazes me that they are swallowed so uncritically and readily and for such a long time by so many scientists without a murmur of protest." Life is a characteristic that distinguishes objects that have signaling and self-sustaining processes from those that do not. Any contiguous living system is called an organism. Organisms undergo metabolism. They maintain homeostasis. They possess a capacity to grow and respond to stimuli. They can reproduce their kind, and they can adapt to their environment in successive generations. A diverse array of living organisms can be found in the biosphere of Earth. And the properties common to these organisms, such as plants, animals, fungi, protists, archaea, and bacteria, are a carbon and a water-based cellular form with complex organization and heritable genetic information. Now, we've been talking heretofore about simple little 10 amino acid peptides. Look at the complexity of cells. You have at the bottom left a prokaryote of one of the simplest bacterial cells. You have on the in that box on the left, on the right hand side, is a plant cell. You can see the chloroplasts in there. And then you have an animal cell at the top left, which is even more complex and has even millions and millions of more molecules in it. And we were just dealing with numbers to make one tiny little 10 amino acid peptide, which would represent zero of all that's in there. So here's a prokaryotic bacterial cell, a little bigger so you can see it. It's a very simple organism. The DNA is not protected. You can see over on the cell types here, those two circles, that the DNA is not protected in the green one, you see, in prokaryotic cells, where there's a nuclear membrane around the nucleus, around the DNA of eukaryotes. Here's a plant cell, which is eukaryotic. You can see those green Chloroplasts, where photosynthesis is done, itself an extremely complicated chemical reaction. You've got the endoplasmic reticulum and the Golgi apparatus, where proteins are translated and modified. You've got the mitochondria, the energy powerhouse of cells, and so on. Aren't they beautiful looking things? Wouldn't you love to say that you could design something that beautiful, especially the colors? Now, we're going to move from biophysics and look at biochemistry, which is my field, but I'm not going to belabor the point. But according to Neo-Darwinism, the mechanism by which life emerged on Earth is unknown, although many hypotheses have been formulated. I'm going to talk about a couple very briefly. The primordial soup theory, which I think you know of. It was proposed by Oparin and Haldane in its mature form, which is the early Earth had a chemically reducing atmosphere. Don't know what evidence they have for that. They just assume that it must have because it fits their theory. That means it has ammonia. You wouldn't be able to survive. You wouldn't be able to live in it. Ammonia, methane, carbon monoxide, and a huge amount of hydrogen, and very little oxygen, because oxygen would make it an oxidizing environment. We need a reducing environment for these chemical reactions we've been talking about to take place, you see. So this atmosphere exposed to energy in various forms, and specifically in the very famous experiment was thought to be lightning, but it could be UV rays, produce simple organic compounds, such as the 10 amino acid peptide. These compounds accumulated in a soup, which may have been concentrated at various locations, shorelines, oceanic vents, for example, and by further transformation, more complex organic polymers developed in the soup. It's spoken like it happened, right? Early Earth had a chemically reducing atmosphere, and you see that depicted here with lightning, and that was the Miller-Urey experiment of 1953. Very, very famous experiment. They had this little apparatus on the right there where you had your ocean simulated by the very bottom right circle. There's water in there, probably threw in a few salts to make it salt water. And up in the big circle in the left-hand side, you have your atmosphere, reducing atmosphere of, as I said, methane, ammonia, hydrogen, carbon monoxide, and water. And you put an electrical spark through there to simulate lightning, and wow, amino acids formed. And they first found 11 back in the 50s. Somebody tells me that with the passing away of Urey, the professor here, that his laboratory still had these things, these flasks closed off, and they went and analyzed them, 50 years later, and found all 20 amino acids plus more, all the 20 that are in your body and mine. Now, here are some of the primordial soup reactions. Again, you've got carbon dioxide, methane gas. We don't need to belabor that one. But it turns out that theory has been thrown out the window, and we now have a new theory of hydrothermal vents, a new site of the beginning of life. And I see that in our high-tech exchange of computers, I've lost my video clip here, but it doesn't matter because we're running short on time anyway. But there's a scientist on here who makes the point at the end of the video that we don't believe in that life began on the surface of Earth anymore. We believe it took place under the ocean in these very deep hydrothermal vents, which I wish we could show you working, but they're called smokestacks. There's a very rich environment. There's a total new ecosystem that wasn't known until very recently down there. It's all based on sulfur, not on oxygen. And so I don't know how they made out. And that one doesn't work either. Now we have problems. Got a little problem here, John. I'm going to the next slide. Let's see if I can hold him there. Stay there. So, perhaps becoming frustrated by complete lack of being able to discover conditions that spontaneously give rise to life, alongside the fact that some scientists were dropping out of the belief system because, it just was full of holes and suppositions that weren't panning out, a new theory came along. And not only that, but they began to say, let's redefine what life is. And I won't go into that, but right now you can read in the scientific literature a lot of... let's see, I don't know it. Hello. It's got a mind of its own. Let's see if we can come back here. Is it still up on the screen? Okay, can you see a circle spinning in the top right? Maybe not. Okay. I'm going to switch over to mine over here, which is, I just don't think I can fast forward to you guys. Oh, okay, so we pop that up. Okay, it's working again. It's done its thinking. So, evolution has occurred right in our midst. Is life smaller than a single cell? Well, I don't believe so, but that is the new study. And all kinds of neat things are being done that I don't think have a lot to do with the subject, but people are getting grants from the NIH to do them, and I'm sure they're having fun. But I won't belabor that point, but we have two, you can see here, genes first hypothesis versus a metabolism first hypothesis now, that we've thrown out, the primordial soup and we've probably even thrown out the hydrothermal vents, and now we're looking at even totally different types of beginnings for life, because the others are not showing any encouraging results in the experiments that have been done now over, I think it's what, 5 billion years or something since it first came out. Anyway, what occurs in these kinds of discussions is that we try to come up with a timeline, which again is something that just I find very difficult if someone's trying to woo me into evolution and believe in it, this is antithetical. You see on the right hand side you have the evolutionary theory there that has put up from prokaryotes, which are very small single cellular bacteria that I showed you that don't have organelles that the eukaryotes do. They would be what I would say would be the very minimal life form. And then you go up to mammals and man. And those are put on a timeline of, say, 3.5 billion years. Do you see that on the bottom? But if you extrapolate a straight line back, you can estimate you can estimate when life began. And look where it cuts the x-axis, where the log of the genome size it becomes 1. Well, it's 9.7 billion years ago that life began. And I remind you that in their estimation, the Earth is only 5 billion years. So it's twice as long as the Earth is old, life began. Well, I'm going to wrap it up here in 4 minutes because I see some heavy eyelids and some more math. It's not going to go very well. But the probability of just 100 amino acids forming is now 1 chance in 10 to the 18,000. And remember, the number of atoms in the entire universe is 10 to the 80. So we're getting to the point where the smart physicists and mathematicians in the world are saying, we don't like this theory anymore. It just can't deal with it. So what do we do if we absolutely can't believe in an intelligent designer or God? Well, we'll make up a new theory and we'll push the whole consideration off into another generation, panspermia. Did that not go? Don't tell me you're not going to let me show them this. Stay there. Yeah. Francis Crick. Who's heard of Francis Crick? Watson and Crick, who discovered the DNA helix. Watson's an American, Crick's an Englishman. Sir Francis Crick is a physicist, mathematician, and he did some of those mathematical calculations and figured out that these probabilities of life occurring through Darwinian evolutionary processes by an undirected random a process is untenable. And so he has come up with because he can't believe in a special creation by God, instead he's come up with a new theory for the origin of life on Earth that he calls directed panspermia. This theory was intended to do something that evolution and its neighbor, punctuated equilibria, that's where you don't have gradual changes, but you have rapid changes caused by meteorites or floods or something like that. But his theory said, I can explain the fossil record, whereas evolution and punctuated equilibria can't. Well, of course, the Bible can explain the fossil record too, but we don't look there because that's not a science. So, we look at an explanation of this. And what is it? Well, it postulates that the roots of our form of life go back to another place in the universe, almost certainly another planet, that it had reached a very advanced form there before anything much had started here, and that life here was seeded by microorganisms sent on some form of spaceship by an advanced civilization. That's the new theory in town. The panspermia theory has been modified a little bit, because it's a wee bit embarrassing, by Fred Hoyle and Chandra Wickramasinghe, and these two scientists discount the belief of an alien spacecraft, and they instead propose that the complex genes, the genes that appear early and abruptly in Earth's history, were manufactured by some intelligence, that part stays, and released into space. And those genes were then set adrift into space like dandelion seeds on a windy spring day. At least three difficulties arise. We've moved off of panspermia. I got a minute left. To the fossil record. I don't think it would be right not to look at fossils. At least three difficulties I've come across from consideration of the fossil record that don't endear me to Darwinian evolutionary theory as a scientist. Firstly, its abrupt transitions offer no support for gradual change. No intermediates have ever been found. You know that problem, right, in the fossil record. New evidence often overturns older theories very readily. And so you really don't know. I mean, do you know the saying, the goalposts keep changing? That's what we're dealing with. And fraud, unfortunately, it happens in all areas of science, but it was very unfortunate for those paleontologists, fossil collectors and so on, naturalists, that two very significant fraud cases didn't help their cause. So let's look at Neanderthal. I'm sure you've heard a Neanderthal. I'm sure you've been called a Neanderthal from time to time. And this was the 1909 version that gave rise to that accusation. And you can see that the artist who was instructed to draw this particular rendition of what they expected Neanderthal man to look like, with huge brow bridges and stooped over, they made him very ape-like because he wasn't hominid, it wasn't thought. He had hair all over his body. Advanced to 2012, now Neanderthal looks like a human. You see? Because research has continued, new data collected, modern museum display now depicts him much more human-like. Now, for 100 years, though, we were indoctrinated that that was Neanderthal man. Oh, sorry, Neanderthal ape man. This is now Neanderthal man who used, there he is again, who uses knives. In fact, he hunted mammoths at the bottom there, made clothes, made sophisticated tools, took care of their sick, buried their dead with flowers, made necklaces out of shell beads, and used makeup. But for 40 years, between 1909 and 40 years into the future, during a very formative time of the development of the Neo-Darwinian theory, Neanderthal was considered an ape man, and it's stuck. It's very difficult to change. Nebraska man, a huge embarrassment to the fossil record, was constructed based upon a single tooth found in a site. And this is what they drew. I think you can see on the right-hand side, he's there with his wife, he's carrying tools, based on a tooth. Well, subsequent analysis showed that the tooth came from a pig. But Nebraska man has been with us for a long time, nevertheless, and has influenced a lot of young lives, unfortunately. You see, you have to be very careful and do some scrutinizing in the data that you put before you. Here's absolute fraud. Piltdown man. Hope you've heard of him. In 1912, he was the rage. He was one of these new jumps he had a modern cranium, modern human cranium, but still possessed the ape-like jaw structure. Well, it turned out that someone had wired an ape-like jaw structure to the human cranium, filed down the teeth a little bit to fit the theory, and later on they saw the file marks. I mean, they'd painted it up with some oxidizing solution that made the bone look old. It was a straight-out-and-out fraud, but nevertheless carried, in England especially, had a huge influence. Who's heard of Lucy? I'm sure you've all heard of Lucy. I've even seen Lucy in the museum in Nairobi. She was considered an ape ancestor of humans who lived in the Rift Valley about 3 million years ago. And her discovery was along the following lines. It's in the middle there. What was found were two things that then were used to synthesize the two, the left and right hand rendition of Lucy. But what was found, you'll notice, is missing the feet. But very close by, within a mile, were human footprints in the volcanic ash. And so they said, mile apart, footprints, skeleton. Must be the same person. So we're going to draw a rendition, put her in the museum for everybody to see and believe. And this was the first ape man who stood erect because had human footprints. So they put human feet on her, even though there were no feet found. And in subsequent, she's known as Australopithecus. You've all heard of that, I'm sure. She was subsequent findings of the bones of Australopithecus have found they had ape-like feet. But Lucy has led us astray. Now, it just happened I was curious as a young man, and I didn't believe it straight up, and I did some reading, investigation, found out about this ash and the skeleton, and thought, wow, I'm not going to be so gullible as to think that those footprints necessarily belong to that skeleton. So we end up with, you know, the fossil record that you've all seen, these diagrams. They're a fait accompli. They must be taught in the school because they are true. Some quotes from scientists who have abandoned Neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory. I'll just last two slides. This is interesting. I thought you'd like the last two. In January of this year, the Pew Foundation survey found that 67% of Democrats believed in evolution, whereas 43% of Republicans did. Remarkably, the latter figure has shrunk by 11%. That is, the Republicans used to be 54%. Now they're down to 43%, and the Democrats have stayed steady at two-thirds. So, commenting on these results, though, a liberal columnist, Tom Krakenmaker, in the USA Today, said he laments there's settled science, evolution is not a matter of opinion or something one chooses to believe in or not, like a religious proposition. And he goes on to say, belief means something different in a religious conversation than it means when we're talking about science. Now, in the case of faith, it usually means accepting, this is him again, accepting the moral and spiritual truth of something and giving it your trust and devotion. In talking about evolution, it is more precise to call it scientifically valid, or an accurate account of what we observe. No leaps of faith or life-altering commitments are required. That's what he said. Well, do you agree with Tom Krakenmaker? I hope after what we've reviewed here today, you will think very carefully about what to believe. I hope you've seen that to ascribe to the Neo-Darwinian theory of evolution, you will have to exercise as much faith, if not more, than you will to believe the biblical account of Genesis, of creation. Where will you put your faith? Thank you very much.